Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and I'm excited to inform you that today on the show we have got the mighty Greg Berendt. This is a fantastic conversation where we kind of touch base on a lot of stuff. And one of the things that we get into right out of the gate is when you sometimes have things going on inside you, in your brain, and they're in direct conflict with your desires, and it stunts your ability to do things the way you want them done. And I bring that up because this is the ninth time I've tried to do this intro on this podcast today. Because I woke up this morning and I was in a mania, and I'm still in the grip of mania. And, you know, the thing about mania is it can be real fun. It feels sort of godlike. It's a wonderful feeling. It does have a crash that accompanies it at the end. And, it can also sometimes really fuck with your ability to just string a sentence together. Because there are so many neurons firing all at once that you can't really follow any thread in a proper direction. So that said, I don't know if I'm going to look back on this conversation and I'm going to feel good about the way I handled everything. I don't know if I'm going to look back on this introduction and feel like I probably should have waited and done it another time, or, you know, done it a 10th time to see if maybe the 10th one was the one that was going to stick and be awesome. But here's the thing. I'm going to be able to look back on this honestly, and it's going to be a real snapshot of where I was, what I was going through, and how I managed it. And what more can you do? That's really about the best you can accomplish on any given day. That's the best I can hope for on any given day. And the conversation does get a little scattered because I was maybe in a bit of a pre-mania before this started. Even a thing? Did I just make that up? You know, not that it matters. The point of all of this is that this is all coming out the way it's coming out. And sometimes perfect is the enemy of good. And I love the fact that this conversation exists in the world. I love the imperfections. I love that I get to share this with you. And I love that I got to share this conversation and this slice of time at a point in our lives when things were what they are with Greg Berendt. So without me rambling anymore, let's talk to Greg. So yeah, right out of the gate. Hi, nice to meet you.
Yeah, good to meet you too.
Yeah, so I have to ask because there's so many different places that we could go. There are so many different avenues of stories that I'm sure you have to tell. But the place that I wanted to start that I thought would be maybe the most interesting is I notice a very noticeable shift in stagecraft and tone. Between mm-hmm. the first stand-up records and the most recent one. Now, is that something that was an intentional evolution for the piece? Because the thing that I noticed was I noticed that there's a lot of discussion of parenting, and the nature of the material itself is pretty hectic and kind of scatterbrained almost in a lot of ways. And it seems like your cadence has become a lot more there's something bubbling under the surface, whereas before it seemed like it was more a lot more smooth. Was that something that was kind of like an intentional shift, or did it just kind of come from the material?
I think it kind of came from the material and the what I was struggling with at the time. It had to do a lot with what was going on in my life and my own relationship with my own brain.
Yeah,
if I'm being honest, that I was I had gotten just like not too far before that special, I was diagnosed as bipolar, and I had been struggling with just an overcrowding in my brain.
Yeah.
And an ability to be able to sort of weed through all of the noise. And that's since been remedied. But that was sort of a hyper period of that. And I was asked to make a record, and we were due. And I didn't necessarily want to make the record, but I didn't have any choice. I'm proud of it. I like it. I like it for what it is. But it's not my favorite.
Yeah. That's a really interesting take on that. I mean, I can definitely relate to that, except I mean, I got diagnosed with bipolar pretty early in life. And so that was something that I was always kind of, you know, learning to manage and take stock in. But, yeah. I can't even imagine getting that, later in life like that. Were you diagnosed an ADHD kid at any point?
No, I was too. I think I was pre that diagnosis.
Yeah.
So, it was just boiled down into hyperactivity and an inability to focus.
Right. Back when a kid could just be a spaz.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then I got put into some of the other classes, you know, some of let's just put slower learning classes.
Mm-hmm.
With some of the other kids, they referred to in Welcome Back Cotter as the sweat hogs. You know, like I was
right.
I was in that sort of classification, which really dates me. But so my diagnosis, which is actually bipolar 2. Is it didn't come until late in life, and it was sort of a slow build, but by the time that record was made, it was at full force, fortunately, not long after that, I got onto a drug that worked for me, and I've been pretty good, you know, ever since.
Yeah, like I had at the height of. I guess you could say the height of my bipolar. I also decided, I mean, it was a little different. I had made a music album, and what I did was I knew I was going to go on medication. I knew I was going to change. I didn't know exactly what was going to change, but I knew something was going to change. Either I was going to feel better or it was all going to go sideways on me and it was just going to be a clusterfuck. But,
right.
But I decided I want to document this as best as I can. So I wrote a whole bunch of songs and I recorded, you know, this terrible album that I can't listen to now. but I am kind of still in an appreciation of the fact that I was able to document that period of my life and that it exists. Do you kind of have that same thing with this record?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's different with a stand-up record because there isn't much. I mean, you either are really funny or you're not, like you don't have a lot of room for other levels, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, people will, you know, I'm certainly you can be more introspective than you were on other records or whatever it is that you want to be. But, I just remember making it. I didn't enjoy it. I was having trouble remembering bits and doing them the same every night. And so one night something would be really spectacular. And the next night I wouldn't understand why it wasn't. And, you know, so, it was almost like just, but I also hadn't made anything in a long time. So it felt more important to get it out than it was to worry about how it came out.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, it's a pretty solid record beginning to end.
Thank you.
You know, I think it came out really well. But let's go back just a little bit further, because there's with so many different places that we could go. I'm actually kind of interested. When did you first feel like maybe there was something about you that you should channel it through something? Because I know that you had said previously in other places that you were kind of a sports guy.
When I was a kid, yeah. When I was really young, careers in comedy and music were not, were uncommon. And sports was something that everybody did and everybody liked and boys seemed to gravitate towards. And it was the way to be popular and the way to be cool. And I think that's what I gravitated towards more than the actual sports themselves. I was not particularly gifted as an athlete, but I liked them and I liked the drama.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to play quarterback, and I had a pretty good arm. But as soon as I got an Aerosmith album, my whole compass changed. And I understood some sort of desire to perform, you know?
Yeah.
And my mom had always intimated that she thought I was funny, but I was really, really more interested in playing music.
Yeah, that's pretty standard. That's kind of par for the course. I mean,
yeah.
You know, comedians always want to be musicians. Musicians always want to be comedians.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And I just dug it. I mean, I just felt like there was a lot more. You could express a lot more yourself through music than you could through comedy, and. But the thing that was kind of cool about that is that when I did go to attempt comedy, I didn't have it. I didn't idolize it so much that I couldn't attempt it. You know what I mean? Like with music, I found it very hard to achieve what it was that I liked. But with comedy, I didn't really have any sort of goal. I just sort of wanted to be the funniest version of me. And I think because I knew less about it than my contemporaries, I was less afraid.
Yeah. Yeah, so you weren't like a big comedy nerd. You were a music guy.
Yeah, totally. Totally. No, I like comedy.
Yeah.
I like Monty Python, and I grew up around in San Francisco, so I knew Robin Williams and all those people when I was a kid, and there was a healthy comedy scene in San Francisco always. So it was always around. It never even occurred to me that that would be something I'd do until I started doing it.
Yeah, and do you think that having played music, that prepared you in any way? I mean, you were probably used to audiences at that point, right?
Yeah, and I'd done theater and all that kind of thing, all that kind of stuff in college. But I think what was great about it, what was liberating about it was, you know, if you've been in a band, you know, it's incredibly difficult to get five people off the ground.
Yeah.
Let alone one. And just the freedom of being able to do stand-up without a guitar, you know, just without anything other than just yourself was kind of amazing.
Yeah. The idea that you can just show up with something and that something is you.
Yeah. You just have to show up with self-will. And so I really dug that part of it, you know, and also I didn't have the experience of being good at things very often. So the fact that I was good at it right off the bat, you know, was kind of a treat, and I didn't take that lightly.
So your first time up, you did okay.
First time up, I did really well, actually. My first time up, my second time, I didn't do well at all, and then it went back and forth.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. I mean, once the first one goes well, I mean, all you got to do is get an audience once, and then you're hooked.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I had, you know, done it in various ways and, you know, just clowning around in high school and all that kind of stuff. But then I did it, you know, for real in front of a comedy club audience and realized, oh, I have a penchant for this. You know, I really might be able to succeed here. And I moved pretty quickly once I started.
Nice. Who are the people you came up with?
I came up with a bunch of really good people. I came up around I started in 89, but I came up in San Francisco with guys like Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn and Blanka Patch, and Mark Maron was around at that time. Mm-hmm. Margaret Cho, Janine Garofalo, David Cross, all the Mr. Show people, all those folks.
Yeah. I mean, but that was a completely different scene at that time as well. I mean, from everything that I've heard about it, it definitely seems like that was sort of the beginning of what would now be called the alternative comedy scene.
Yeah, we caught a wave right there, right in between the end of the 80s comedy boom and the 90s. You know, there was just this sort of crash, and then there were kids working and they couldn't get into the clubs and started working in alternative venues.
Yeah.
And sort of were doing things on their own. And it was all sort of hand in hand with the alternative music movement and Nirvana and all that stuff. And it all sort of kind of went in a wave, the early MTV and they were trying to discover young comics, and suddenly there were all these different cable shows on. And so there were a lot of places for us to go.
Yeah.
And it spawned a really pretty large scene.
Yeah, and a lot more places for people to express themselves. And so there were a lot more varied voices, because you'd still have, you know, your typical road guys, you know, and I've definitely heard of people having to pull out, let's say more traditional material, depending on the crowd that they're going to be facing, rather than, you know, just staring angrily at a stool for a minute and calling it art. I mean, so,
yeah.
But it is kind of great that you would have an opportunity to do something, you know, so different. There had to be some kind of feeling of safety in all of that.
Well, I mean, there is that sort of safety in numbers thing. And like all of us were, I mean, you know, alternative really refers to the venue, because everybody had their own way of going at comedy, and there wasn't any particular one right way to do it.
Sure.
I mean, we were definitely children of the 90s, so we were suspect of everything, and caustic, and I think very very sure of ourselves. We also were limited in our, you know, in what we thought was okay. I mean, you really had to sort of fit through a pinhole for us to think you were okay. And of course that would change over time. You know, we didn't like anybody who had a guitar. We didn't like anybody who, had a costume of any kind, or anybody who assumed a character, you know, until Tenacious D came along, and then they were okay. You know what I mean? Like, the pendulum swings back and forth, and, you know, comedy is just good comedy is just good comedy, regardless of the shape it comes in.
Yeah, but that comes with some kind of a emotional maturity as well.
Yeah, we just like to cry sell out a lot at everybody. No matter if you did a callback or if you did an imitation, people were like, "Oh, that's easy. You're a sellout." And, you know, of course, that doesn't last.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I cut my teeth in punk bands. And so it was definitely a whole lot of that posturing, you know. Well, I don't know a whole lot about myself, but I know that I bought this uniform.
Yeah, totally. And I identify with this really easy set of rules that defines me in a really simple way.
Yeah.
And I know what I know it's digestible and not to me, because I know more what I don't like than what I do like.
Yeah.
But after a while, those beliefs become incredibly limiting, and also ultimately you fall prey to something that makes you want to be above.
Yeah. So what in all of this, you've got a career in stand-up comedy going, mm-hmm. and then like you're picking up work in other places. And I obviously I've got to go here. The book comes along and everything.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for as punk rock as I thought I was, I ended up on, as a staff member on Sex and the City, and, which was, for some people kind of a hip show, but not for everybody. And then, you know, in the process of working there, I ended up giving somebody some real advice in real time about a relationship they were having, and it made it into an episode. of the show. And then afterwards it was posited by somebody else, my friend Liz, that it become a book.
Yeah.
Just not that into you. And so we did that for fun and for, you know, almost like they say, for fun and for free. Like, you know, we didn't expect anything to happen to it. It just was a kind of a cool idea. And the next thing you know, I'm sitting next to Oprah.
Which is, you know, not something that a lot of people do.
No, and not that punk rock either.
Yeah.
You know,
precisely.
You know, yeah. I mean, it was the least of, and I think that's the funny thing about life, is that you can dictate who it is you think you are, but life will ultimately, you know, reveal more to you. And I was grateful to be on Oprah and happy for all the experiences, but it was really strange to find myself in that place, having not pursued a career in self-help at all in any way, and then had never considered it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll say this about that book, too, because that was a book that I knew about for a long time, and I knew that you were involved in it, but I never did get around to reading it until pretty recently, after I had actually read How to Keep Your Marriage from Sucking, the book you wrote with your wife, Amira.
Thank you.
Yeah, so
yes.
I kind of have a strange situation. And the situation that I've got is that my wife and I have been together for a few years now. And she, you know, went out in the world and wanted to see what she was worth. She got her master's degree and found a really kick-ass job in California. But we live in Denver.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So she left. And we see each other via commute once a month.
Wow.
And we talk on the phone every day. But, you know, I was just looking for tools to keep things sharp. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, especially when you're that far apart, after a certain amount of time, you start revealing the weaknesses because the strengths aren't there to overcompensate for them.
Right.
So I was looking for something, and wouldn't you know it, I found that book. Which ultimately actually led me to, he's just not that into you, which really actually made me examine myself as the person I was at the time frame in which that book was written. And I found that actually very therapeutic, because I understood a lot of the horrible behaviors that I exhibited. And then, you summed it up pretty beautifully with, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the thing that you had said was, I've never actually seen a guy change unless the person he's with changes. It was something along those lines. And I can say absolutely, there have been times in this relationship with my wife where, you know, it was just no question. This is how I'm going to handle it. And, you know, I don't think that I could have handled being apart from any of the people I was with before.
Yeah, well, it's tough, man. That's a tough. I mean, that is I admire that you guys are doing that. I mean, and also I'm, you know, I don't know that I could do the same. I don't know if I could do the same.
Yeah.
You know, but also, you know, the thing that you do find out about relationships is that, like, what works for you, if it works for you, it works for you.
Yeah.
And there are hard and fast rules about what other people do in life don't mean a hill of beans, man, because every relationship has its snowflake quality of being its own thing, you know, and only you and that other person will ever truly understand what you mean to each other, you know, and there's no taking it away from you. There's no, you know, even if that person goes on to be in relationships with other people, there's nothing they can do to sort of sully or change what you had between you, you know, that's so interesting. Well, that first book, look, the thing that's so interesting about it was when we wrote it, and I said this at the time, meaning it, because I didn't expect it, but I was like, I will never have to write another book. This book, in some weird ways, it says it all.
Yeah.
You know, it married, not married, you know, it doesn't matter really your gender or your relationship status, you know, people need to treat you like you deserve to be treated. and we know what showing up looks like.
Yes. Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's the entire through line of the whole thing, of taking a look at every one of those situations and the relationships that were being presented to you, and running them through this sieve of what kind of a person are you going to show up as for the person you care about? And are you showing up for each other?
Right, exactly. And have you agreed to something you don't agree with, you know, and have you, you know, because I think one of the hardest things about being in a relationship is maintaining your sense of self, you know, and maintaining the you that was you when you first started.
Yeah.
But that is sort of the key, because that's the person that they fell in love with. And that person had a set of rules, and those rules, you know, for the most part, tend to apply all the way through.
Yeah, I just thought the whole thing was pretty amazing. To be able to look through that even now, you know, because the book now is what, how many years old?
Like
18, 15, something like 18? That.
18. Yeah. It came out in 2004.
Yeah. Okay. So it's absolutely, you know, evergreen in a lot of ways, because ultimately it's all just a matter of trying to figure out how to be a decent human being when you cut it all down to its roots.
Yeah. I mean, it ascribes a certain, you know, the thing that was interesting about it was we didn't take the point of view that you had screwed up in any way. You know, we didn't find the reader culpable.
Yeah.
You know, we looked at their situation and said, you know, are they showing up for you? Are they giving you mixed messages? You know, are they hard to be with? Are they complicated? Are they, so that you had a chance to, like, the self-evaluation comes later, and everybody goes through that.
Yeah.
You know, but you have to have a basis for which you are judging something.
Right. But you've been with Amira for a really long time, right?
19 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been being with somebody who struggles with bipolar disorder and, you know, is in recovery and all the rest of it. And I've had cancer twice. And, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's a tough ride.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, that's actually a lot more of a ride than most people would bargain for. If you even take just one of those things and lay them at someone's feet, mm-hmm. most people say, catch you later.
No, and trust me, it's been said to me, this isn't what I bargained for. And you also have to say, no, me either.
Yeah.
But it's understandable. And I, you know, look, there have been parts in our relationship where we've talked about the idea of walking away, because it just can be very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to take somebody through a super bad time, you know, and nobody wants to be the cause of somebody's bad time. You know, and especially when you struggle with depression and you can't seem to monitor your own behavior, you know, that you are almost a prisoner to a mental disorder. You know, it's easy to say to somebody, look, you may need to get out of here because I don't know when this is going to get better.
Right. And that's the real crux of the situation, too, when you're dealing with something like bipolar, is that you can't necessarily run any kind of predictors on when things are going to go sideways for you. You know, you could wake up right. You could wake up in the morning and everything is great. And then for no reason whatsoever, suddenly there's a gray film over everything in the world and your feelings have been hijacked. You're now a hostage to your own chemicals.
Yeah. And and there's nothing like it. I mean, and sometimes those clouds come in and stay for a couple of days. Sometimes they leave in a couple of hours. It all depends. And it's debilitating on a level that's difficult, but I can only imagine it's also really difficult for, you know, at least to a certain degree, at least you're watching what's going on and can broadcast a little bit from there. But if you're on the receiving end of it, you're just confused. And
yeah.
And your tendency is to want to pull away. As much as you think somebody would want to be empathetic towards you, they want to pull away because they don't know what the ride is.
Yeah, no, completely. My wife is a scientist, and so she doesn't handle that emotion shit real well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
no, I know,
but that's got to be there's a part of me that actually really wonders, like, personality wise, how different are you and your wife?
We're very different. I mean, we're really different. And as time has gone on, we've proven to be a little bit more different. I think in the beginning, there's a tendency to sort of think somebody is like you and to almost wish fulfill it. But as time goes on, you start to see, oh, no, they're a different human being. They actually like things differently than I like them. And then you have to either you have to adjust or you start finding conflict. And, you know, my wife is a person who likes some space,
yeah,
and some time, and is not as deeply romantic as I am. And while I thought we were both romantic, you know, turns out really, you know, I carried the crux of that, and that's okay. You know,
yeah,
that's just who we are.
Yeah.
If we were both like me, we'd never get anything done. So, you know, thank God, she has a practical side to her.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. My wife and I are the exact same way. You know, if one of us wasn't, you know, sort of type A and practical, I think all of this would have gone sideways a long time ago.
Right. But my wife can also appear cold to me and distant.
Yeah.
And I can find that super frustrating, as in, how come you don't feel this way about this that I do? But, you know, people have their, and also that's what I call it. I call it cold and distant. I don't know that she's not feeling it deeply and quietly.
Yeah.
You know, and just doing it differently than me. I broadcast everything.
Yeah.
You know, every emotion I have, every moment I have, everything I'm thinking, you know, every revelation I have, every epiphany comes blasting out of me like I'm some kind of a radio, you know?
Right.
And that I'm having these, you know, new ideas all the time. And I can be very emotional about things. And I think I can also, and I can take over the whole room, and I can also tire people out.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. That's one of the things that's difficult for people to get through their head. And one of the reasons I also decided to start having conversations with people about this in the first place was because sometimes you kind of are a problem, you know, like your shit can bum people out. Your situation can be an issue, and it's a matter of finding ways around to live with and live through a lot of your own nonsense.
Oh my God. I mean, I am the problem. I have been the problem quite a bit, but I'm also, you know, it's people like us are the people that, like, I'm the guy that starts a band, and I'm also the guy that wrecks it.
Yes.
You know, I'm the guy that gets everyone together behind a good idea, and then I'm the guy that gets his feelings hurt while doing it. You know, I'm the guy that has the control issues. I'm the guy that has the, you know, why can't everyone be the way that I expect them to be?
Right.
The thing, this was my idea, you know. So we're often generators of good ideas, and we're the people that like to call the party and get everything going. But at the same time, we're also the ones with the most at stake, and we tend to, you know, personalize everything. And, you know, yeah, I can really be the problem.
It's almost like being on, you know, like an emotional cocaine. You know, you really get some ideas and you get some things going, and then by the time things are in the middle of it, you can find yourself just fucking exhausted.
Yes, and I have been, in the last year, I've been dedicating myself to the study of stillness and being quiet and putting both my feet on the floor and listening, and then trying to not say something at the end of somebody else's sentence, to try and not top the story, or to try to even just process what I've heard. I don't always have to, you know, with my wife, it turns out she can finish a story and I don't have to say anything.
Yeah.
And then that's just fine, you know? And she doesn't have to react to me, and she doesn't have to let me talk, and it's all fine, you know? I always get my chance, and I have found in this study that once I do that, I find people asking me more questions.
Yeah.
And people are more interested when I stay still. Yeah. But when I'm a motivated, in motion, you know, person, I can be very difficult to be around.
Yeah. Yeah, I have that exact same thing. I just started trying to figure out meditation in this past year because I can't handle any form of silence.
Right.
You know, once the silence starts, then all of the voices that are inside you that have been waiting to speak start saying things, and it's never anything good.
No, and that's the thing. Like, meditation's been a real revelation for me, and I've been doing it now for about 2 years. I get up most mornings at around 5 and meditate for, I try to get it done for an hour, you know? And I usually do some sort of guided meditation because I need someone whispering in my ear. But I haven't talked about it a lot because it's not a formal practice. But I have been doing it for as consistently as I've done anything. And it has changed the way that I approach conversations and relationships and even my own work. You know, I think it would be interesting if I recorded a stand-up album today because it would be a lot steadier and a lot quieter. And I hopefully funny. Fuck, that would be, I mean, it would be great if it was funny.
Yeah.
That would be super helpful. But you know, because I have begun to look to see what the rest of my life is going to be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm also, you know, I'm no spring chicken. So, you know, I'm just an old punk rocker trying to figure out what's the next phase going to be about. Cause I want it to be about something different.
Yeah.
You know, I've done plenty of yelling.
Well, you know, and it's funny you mentioned that too. Because Pretty late, it seems, you started your band where nobody does any yelling.
Yes. No, there's zero yelling in our band. Yeah. Well, that was just out of a pure desire to, like, I just, you know, I have such a thing for surf bands and for instrumental music. And I wanted, in every band I'd ever been in prior to this band, the problem was always the singer.
Yeah.
And so I just eliminated the singer and started making music that if I only ever heard it out of the dashboard of my car, that would be fine.
Yeah. And I think that's the best way to approach any kind of art form is to make something that doesn't exist in the world because you want to hear it.
100%. And I love it and I'm proud of it. And I have a great time making it. You know, we don't get together to play as much just because there's too many people in the band and it's a hassle to get old men to make music. There are days where I just wish I played in a power trio that made nothing but noise.
Yeah.
But I mean, just a racket. I mean, you know, the stuff that we make with the Monarchs gets pretty sophisticated after a while. And suddenly I realize I can't play my own songs.
It does, but it does have, like a, you know, that little undercurrent that reminds me of, you know, like Husker Du or the Pixies.
Oh, thank you.
You know what I mean? Like it's got that underpinning of, you know, potential violence.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Like I write a lot of the initial riffs and create a lot of that stuff. And Mike, who produces the records and plays a lot of the lead stuff, you know, he was just my guitar teacher. And then I said, I wanted to write a song to come up on stage to, called Fanfare for a Well-Dressed Man. And then we just, he said, do you have any other songs? And I'm like, well, I got this. And then we just kept going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have both of those records. And they're really good. They're really good records. But, just look at everything that we've covered so far. We've talked about so many different things. I don't even know like how you've gone through all of these various stages of everything. You briefly touched on for a moment the fact that you got sober, the fact that you had cancer twice.
Twice, yeah.
And then come out the other side, you know, learning meditation. Do you fight with yourself before you get better? Is that your typical process?
It used to be. I definitely did. And I, you know, I struggle. I mean, I think like anybody in show business, you know, you struggle for an identity sometimes. And you're constantly comparing yourself with whoever else is doing what you do. But I also was really afraid, you know, part of it is afraid of like not, doing those things that were true in my heart before I die. Like that thing of like, look, I just want to have a surf band. I don't really care what the cost. And
yeah,
you know, I'm going to do that. And I'm also going to write relationship books because that's come up for me. And I'm going to learn how to do that. And I'm going to keep doing stand up and we're going to see how it all goes, you know. And I'm also going to turn 56 years old as a white male in show business. And it's going to be difficult in some ways.
Yeah.
Because of the time, and at the same time, it's going to be beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to learn through all of that. But, I mean, were you worried when you started to take medication that it might hamper you in any way? Did you have any of those doubts?
No, because I was ready to quit everything if I could get better. You know, I was happy to, like, I really was like, I don't care. Like, it never, I wasn't afraid that I was going to lose my ability to do stand up. I didn't care. I wanted to be able to get out of bed. I wanted to be able to have conversations with people where I wasn't continuing to talk all yes. the time. Like I wanted to be able to be a rational, helpful human being. You know, I wanted to be a person who could listen. And so I was willing to trade everything for it. I really didn't care. I'll go work at a Trader Joe's. Like it doesn't matter to me if I can get my mental health together, because I'm the father of two girls.
Yes.
You know, and their lives are far more important to me than anything else that I'm doing.
Absolutely. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I lucked out, and then I found a medication. I'm on a thing called Latuda, and I've been on it for probably 8 months now, and it took about a month and a half to really kick in.
Yeah.
And it changed everything.
Man, that's...
I get a little sleepy. Not to lie to you. I got to take it at night because it'll put me out for a while. And then, it's the quiet in my head is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, I had probably a 15-year stretch where I was managing my mental health with nothing but, you know, my wits and whatever seemed like a good idea, which isn't a good idea,
right?
You know, when you can't trust your own brain.
Right.
It's like I'm reading this Wikipedia that I edited. It's not doing me any good. So
right.
I hit a dark patch myself. You know, probably around, right after my wife moved out, you know, it sounds so crazy to say that, but
yeah.
right after my wife moved, I didn't have to hold shit together for anybody. I just had to go to work.
Right.
So that's all I did. And I slept and I got more depressed, and the depression, it was like it was waiting. And I just said, fuck it. I don't care about anything anymore. And I finally realized this is no way to be. I mean, I got kids too. So it's like, I got to put myself together because I'm no good for anybody, let alone myself. I'm going to go see about some pills. Let's see what's what. Cause I was already seeing a therapist and I got on some medication, and yeah, it's been crazy how much it's helped.
Yeah. I mean, there is, you know, for all of the, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing about the different drugs and people being on prescriptions and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's a, you know, these are pioneer days with this medicine, and they don't necessarily know how to prescribe it to everybody. And I don't think everybody knows how to react to it.
Yeah.
And I think some people pull the trigger too quickly. And, you know, because I think I fortunately took so many drugs in my life that I know that drugs have an initiation period. So it's like whenever I would in college take mushrooms or something, there's always that weird crappy part before the beginning, before it starts to feel okay. And same with anything else, there's that uneasiness and that sort of unsure, and you know, that happens with these meds too. You take them and then you feel like, maybe I feel okay. And then I don't know if I feel so good, and it takes a while, and then they kick in. But, you know, that can be upwards of 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And then most people are like, I'm out of here, because they're expecting some kind of immediate sensation or cure, you know. And also the thing is that these meds tend to take away from you as opposed to add to you. So they will curb your ups and downs a little bit.
Right.
It didn't make me less funny. It just made me unable to lift bad ideas as well as, you know, have to push a little bit harder on the good ones.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, but ultimately, that's a worthwhile struggle.
Yes, but I never found that my stand-up, like, I got up on stage, and while it would feel different the way that I told it, I still got the same reactions. I still had the same, I still was able to get laughs, and I still enjoyed it. But I also didn't walk away from it so deluded by my own success that I thought, oh, man, I don't understand why Netflix isn't giving me a special, you know? You know, I would be able to walk away and go, that was good. That was enjoyable. It could be better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely like those unrealistic feelings of, you know, that godlike roller coaster. I mean, that's a wonderful feeling, but it is something that you have to recognize. For one, it's not real. For two, it's not sustainable.
Well, that's the thing. I started to get as afraid of the highs as I did the lows, because the highs I knew weren't sustainable, and I knew that I would crash eventually. And so when I would have that rush, like that coffee rush of like, oh my God, we may have written the best song that's ever been written, you know, and then realize just I like it, you know, and then I'll find out soon enough if it's the best song ever written, you know, that the results will come in time, and some of them will be great and surprising. And so I'm allowed to be a little bit more surprised by life because I have left it less demands of it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't expect things to be, you know, beyond my wildest dreams all the time.
Well, and at the other end of that spectrum, you've spent an entire career of learning how to actually discipline yourself into crafting your art. So it's not all, you know, I think people give their addictions and their mental illness way too much credit for their ability to create shit. If you're a creative person, it's in you. You may have to struggle a little harder to pull it out if you're a person who's always relied on the muse of your sadness or being high or being drunk. You may have to pull a little harder, but it's all there. You're still ultimately, you know, the Michelangelo digging around in the marble.
Right. I mean, usually you've found a groove, and so maybe that groove is sadness, but you may have an ability to then find a groove in the mundane.
Yeah.
Or find a groove in joy, or able to, you know, I think sometimes we get tied to certain ideas about ourselves, or we get tied to an idea that we have about our persona, and we're afraid if that persona changes, everyone's going to give a shit, when in fact, nobody knows, and everybody thought you were more multidimensional to begin with. You know, that's the thing, is like, most people see you as multidimensional, but you see yourself as two-dimensional, and so you assume you're this certain type of person. You know, my taste in music is not really who I am. I mean, I listen to a lot of punk rock music, but I don't think people feel threatened by me or that at any moment I'm going to start a revolution. It just isn't how I seem, as much as that's the music that I love.
Yeah, but a lot of times too, that's a reaction to something, you know, within your personality. Because I've always put myself in kind of a similar box where it's like, you know, I'm not the guy showing up with a mohawk. You know, I'm the guy with a plain t-shirt and a normal haircut and some glasses. Like it's just kind of, this is what I like listening to, but I don't need the uniform.
Right. And then you realize that like, you know, sometimes people have the uniform that fits it, but a lot of times they don't. And they come in different boxes than you expected them to.
Right.
And there, you know, it's that thing of like, anytime you hear Steve Jones talk and you listen to him talk about his taste in music, and it couldn't be less Sex Pistols, you know,
right.
I mean, it just couldn't, you know,
yeah.
I mean, he likes show tunes. Like he's really is not that much of a rebel, you know, as much as he was just an artist.
Sure. You know, even Joe Strummer at the end was talking about, you know, I think we had a lot more in common with the hippies than we thought.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. But you're young in those moments when you're young and you're trying to solidify who you are. And then, like I said before, it's easier to tell people what's wrong with them than what's right about you. And I think, you know, you pick sides, and then, you know, and I see it with young comics all the time. Like, I meet young comics and they don't like this, and they don't like that, and they think this is stupid. And I remember being like that, and I'm just exhausted by them.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, I remember being that young and hating everything. And now I just like, I mean, I like so much more than I dislike.
I wonder what it would do for your personality to bypass that phase, though. I almost wonder if that phase is a necessary component when you're young and hungry.
Yeah, I mean, I picked out the way I dress, and I like the way I've dressed the same ever since. And I like that about myself. I like the, you know, I like the style that I picked. I like what I chose then. I like that I saw people in Social Distortion and went, that's how I'm going to look for the rest of my life. A chain wallet and a crew cut and a, you know, and a pair of boots. And, but, you know, I think it's a necessary, it's fun to watch my daughter's a bit of a, you know, she's becoming a bit of a pessimist and a little bit of a, and she'll call me out. Like one day she said to me, I see you're wearing a lot of statement jewelry these days. And I, you know, cause I wear a tiki and sometimes yeah. I have a rosary that has Johnny Thunders on it. And, nice. And yeah, it's silly old punk rock stuff.
Yeah.
Know? And you know, I'm a big lover of the Cramps, and I love Lux, and I wear sort of stuff like that, but I love that she had to call me out for wearing statement jewelry, and it was just her defining her sense of what she notices and what's cool and what's not cool. And her ability to be able to maybe throw a little shit at me, which I kind of loved. I loved it, actually.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's a way you know that she's going to be okay.
She's going to be fine, yeah. And she's got a sense of humor, and she also knows how to dig a little bit. And I think that's because she's trying to figure out who she is.
Right.
And she's trying to define what matters to her and what falls in and outside of the parameters of cool.
Yeah.
You know, for a girl her age. And, she's still she's my favorite. I mean, she's just absolutely hilarious, and I would be bummed if she didn't do stuff like that. I'm you know, I thrilled to the idea that I'm going to walk over and she's going to make fun of my pants or, you know, something that I do. I've been doing the same thing for so long; it doesn't affect me.
Yeah,
you know, if I just had started wearing jewelry, I think we would have all had a problem.
Yeah, because that's, you know, you've been one thing for so long, you can't go changing that much that quickly.
No, and I've grown to love it. I'm grown to be okay with it. You know, like I like the sort of predictability of what I'm going to wear and where I'm going to wear it. And even though I go to stores to look at clothes all the time, I'm going to buy in the same categories as I normally do, you know, and I still, you know, I'm old, so I listen, you know, I still listen to the Cramps constantly. And I still listen to, you know, certain records and things from the old days. And then I'll go through a period of like, oh, now I'm listening to nothing but Cal Jader, you know, sort of, you know, exotic jazz from the 60s, you know, and loving it and thinking it's as punk rock as anything I've heard. And having my girls go, what is happening in the car, Dad?
Yeah.
They just do not know what that is at all. And they don't get the references. They are just like, get it off. But he's really hitting those vibes, man. He's really laying it down. Can't you hear him? He's on fire. And they're, you know, they don't want to, you know, they want to hear Tyler, the Creator.
Yeah. So as we're wrapping it up here, it sounds like you figured out how to lay into a groove of who you are.
Yeah.
Through stops and starts, you know, of various tragedies and whatnot. What gave you the presence to hold yourself together when so many of these things just fell right on top of you?
Well, you know, I think probably, it probably was sort of, I can't say this for sure, part of it was the meditation of just getting present, you know, just try and be right now in this moment and realize that, you know, the more here you are, the less all the other stuff really matters. And maybe you've carved out a nice life for yourself. And maybe there's things about yourself that you should be proud of, and that maybe you should lean into those things and continue them, because you've got a couple of kids watching you grow older. And what they need is some consistency. You know, and what they value is you being you. You know what I mean? I mean, you're supposed to be on the outs when you have kids. You're supposed to be a nerd. You're supposed to be not cool. You're supposed to have the dumbest ideas. You know?
Yeah.
And that suits me just so perfectly. I wish I had thought about that when I was a kid. You know, that all I want to be is a square.
Yeah. You know, because there's no one that you have to please anymore. There's just people that you have to be in service of.
Yeah, and I even had to learn that with my wife. You know, for a long time, my wife was the higher power in our relationship, and then I finally went, man, that's not how it works, and that's not who she fell in love with. You know, the thing that's always exciting about people is when they love themselves and when they can't help but be themselves.
Yeah,
the most empowering thing anybody can be is themselves, and that's what people want from you. You think people want something different from you. And I think when you falter with people, it's when you lose your ground being yourself, when you're unsure, and when you are or holding them accountable for who you are. You know, people want to be told and they want to be shown. And so, you know, sort of finding what it is you love about yourself and accentuating that really makes things easier for everybody else, you know, because then they see your comfort. And, you know, and like I said, I'm not defending any territory anymore. So I'm happy to have you disagree with my taste.
Yeah.
But I'm going to listen to that Ramon song again. And I'm going to keep rolling my jeans up too high, and I'm going to wear penny loafers. And I know you're going to say Michael Jackson, and I'm going to go, no, James Dean, man, you're way off.
Yeah. But that's all part of getting comfortable in your own skin.
And there have been people, look, there's people that have been like that since they're kids that have that kind of comfort. I mean, I think that's some of the people that we really admire are people who found that comfort in their skin, you know. And I struggled for such a long time with my mental illness and my, you know, put me on the edge so often, and I was so unsure and so sort of also paranoid towards the end, you know, that once I got on the other side of this thing, I thought, holy cow, I got to enjoy this.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful place to wind up, especially, you know, when the scale could really tip in either direction. You know,
yeah.
There's so much chaos involved that, you know, looking at things as beautiful and wonderful and enjoyable, it is a lot easier to start taking things as moments in the present versus,
yeah,
you know, thinking about who you're actually going to show up as on a regular, continuous basis, because that's a lot more difficult. It's a whole other conversation.
God. Yeah, yeah. Trying to figure out who you're going to show up as and what you're going to project and what you're going to get from that, you know, is exhausting. And also, it wastes a lot of time. And the other thing that, you know, that I've had, obviously, is having had cancer twice, is a sense of mortality.
Yeah.
You know, I've lived more years than I'm probably going to continue to live. I don't see me going to 112.
Right.
So, and I don't know that I want to, but I am happy then to try and really suck the life out of the moments I have. And, you know, not all the time, every day. I have my frets and worries like everybody else. I get caught up in it, but I'm able to sort of reset and remember that, you know, I don't know what's going to be magical today. And so I don't have to have a worry about what today is going to shape out to be, because it'll be different than I thought it was.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something to the idea of hitting a certain point in knowing that you've probably got less time left than you've already been given. And it is kind of wonderful, especially if you're an artistic type, to be able to look at everything that you've that you've put together and that you've left behind, the things that you've made, as some kind of an interesting, living document. Like, you know, this is what I did with my life. Can I feel okay that this exists in the world where previously there was nothing? And I think if you've made something, even if it's flawed, you know, even in the way that you're not necessarily thrilled with the way that that stand-up record came out, there is something kind of beautiful about the fact that it chronicles something different for you than it is going to for the person who listens to it.
Oh, completely. And that I got the opportunity to make it. And that, yeah. And that the majority of, you know, look, I lucked out at one point and I hit the sort of jackpot of the consciousness, you know, and for, you know, a brief moment, He's Just Not That Into You became a thing that was a revelation to a lot of people. And it was helpful. It was helpful to a lot of people who were stuck in crappy relationships. And I got to, and I had that is that, that no one will ever take that away from me. That was a moment that I had with the help of Oprah Winfrey and my wife and the woman I wrote the book with. But, you know, it was a collaborative experience that happened, and it congealed, and I'm proud of it. And it, you know, and it was what it was, but I wasn't going to stop making stuff after that.
Right.
And I didn't expect my surf records to do the same thing. but if no one ever hears them, it doesn't matter, because I made them. Because I'm also not living this life just to leave stuff behind. I want to leave a legacy of kindness behind.
Absolutely.
You know, I want to be the guy that was able to recover from his bipolar disorder and sort of right the wrongs of that time period and go on to sort of help other people get through it themselves.
Yeah. No, absolutely. There's very few things that you could do with, you know, everything that you've been given, the platform that you have, the sheer number of chances that you've been given that have, you know, led to you being able to end up where you are, the people who took a chance on you, everything that has gotten to you to the point where you are, the idea that it's not lost on you, that these moments that'll happen, like being on Oprah or even just being on stage with the surf band, it's like your brain may deliver the same dopamine spike for those as it would for washing the dishes. You know,
right.
The only difference between those things is ultimately really in your head, because if you let it get in your head too much, it can taint the whole thing. But staying grounded about something like that and recognizing there's something really wonderful and special about this, but it doesn't mean I get to stop, is exactly the right attitude.
Right. And the delight and the endorphins that go off when I'm sitting on Oprah, or if I'm playing the Doll Hut with the band and there's 12 people there, you know, it's the same. I'm still joyful. I'm still like, oh my God, I'm living. I'm living my life.
Yes.
I'm in front of people living my life and experiencing something that I created, and I'm also doing it in concert with other people. And that experience in and of itself, I mean, I'm just as delighted on a birthday when I'm surprised by a gift. Like there's no quantifying what happiness feels like. It takes shape in lots of different ways. And sometimes for me, it's been in front of a lot of people and other times it's been in a room full of four, you know?
Right. Yeah. And you will have those quiet moments with your family that are, you know, much more meaningful than the simple, you know, the singular pursuits, but they're also very different things.
Yeah. Yeah. And peace too. And finding some peace, being able to just be able to be comfortable in my own skin going to bed at night.
Yeah.
You know, and laying down knowing that even if it was just me, it would all be okay. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Taking all of that in, and learning how to be able to sit with yourself in the silence and feel comfortable. I mean, that's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah. Yeah. And not depending on anybody else or any other thing for your happiness, you know, and letting everything else sort of be a bonus or not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's absolutely amazing. I think that's just as good a place as any.
Good, man.
Thanks for talking to me, Greg.
Hey, I really enjoyed this, and I'm glad we finally got it together, and I appreciate your patience with me.
No, this was really great. Thank you.
All right, man. Let's do it again soon.
And there you have it, the conversation with the mighty Greg Behrendt. I really can't thank him enough. He was the coolest guy, a great conversation, and I definitely would like to talk to him again because I feel like we barely scratched the surface on a number of things. That said, if you want to find out more about Greg, there are about a million links in the feed below. Be sure to check out his Instagram at It's Gregers. It's an awesome account. He has all kinds of little videos with tips and tricks on how to make your life work for you. As for me, next weekend I'll be opening for Candlebox with my band Decatur. And I don't know why I'm telling you this, because I'm pretty sure the show is sold out. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.